This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A top pediatrician recently stirred a long simmering pot for many parents with an editorial on attention deficit disorder. Dr. Dimitri Kistakis says we're thinking about ADD all wrong, that the way doctors currently make a diagnosis creates too big a divide. Kids end up either labeled and medicated or without any educational supports whatsoever. Instead, he argues we should consider attentional capacity on a spectrum, varying by individual and situation. And while many experts agree that a more nuanced approach is required, there is still disagreement about whether the right criteria are being used to diagnose the disorder, how big a role medication should play, and whether our lifestyles and education system are as big an issue as our brains. Today in The Exchange, we're jumping back into this discussion with three New Hampshire experts. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions, comments, concerns about attention deficit disorder and kids, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Joining us from the Hanover area is Dr. Burl Davis, pediatric psychiatrist at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine, who specializes in the pharmacological treatment of ADHD and mood disorders in youth and young adults. And Dr. Davis, it's really nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Laura. It's great to be here.
Also with us, Barbara White, developmental psychologist and occupational therapy professor at UNH, with research interests in stress, stimulant medication abuse, and disorders of attention. And Professor White, it's good to have you too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your invitation.
And also with us, David Parker, founder and director of Parker Education, a private day school and tutoring center in Concord. Parker Education is accredited to provide programs for students with a wide array of learning challenges. And David Parker, good to see you. Welcome back to The Exchange.
Great to be here.
Well, all of you, but I'll turn to you first, I think, David. Mm-hmm. What's new in terms of how we regard attention deficit disorder? It's been about 30 years since people have been talking about this.
Well, I think I agree with what the professor said prior in your article. I think there's many nuances regarding ADD and ADHD. And when it was diagnosed 30 years ago, you sort of had it or you did. Now I think we're looking at what are those variables that impact it. How, and spectrum is a really nice way to think about it because you can have it to a large degree or to a lesser degree. Environments play a big role because with ADHD you have inattention, you have lack of organization, you're easily distracted. But in certain environments, those things can work for you. So I think we're looking at a more nuanced aspect of it as well as what also exists with it. What's the intelligence? What's the stress? I'm sure Barbara could speak to that. Is there depression? Is there other conditions that are affecting ADHD?
What comes along with it?
I think we're looking at it in many more nuanced ways.
So it used to be 30 years ago, 20 years ago, David, it was sort of black and white. You had it or you didn't, and it was a big concern or not a concern at all. Now it's more subtle. This, again, the word spectrum is maybe the perfect way to think about this.
Well, I think with any new diagnosis, it has to get played out over time to see its nuances.
What have you seen, Professor White, in terms of how we talk about this, think about this?
Well, I think we're moving in the right direction. I think looking at it as a capacity that is variable among humans, just like all capacities that we have, right? I've thought for a long time that for many of these kids, it should be called a variable attention affordance because it gives them the ability to see things differently in places where other kids might not, right? So those of us who have variable attention can actually have a gift in certain places, although it might be a pain in some others. But in the right environment, it can actually be something to be proud of and not carry as a liability. Have somebody told you that something's wrong with you, rather than saying that you have gifts in certain areas, and so let's explore those, where those might be. So I think we're heading in the right direction with it.
You know, you're picking up on something that I've been reading more and more about lately, Professor White, the idea that society should stop seeing ADHD as a problem and start embracing the positive aspects of it. Like there's a book, The ADHD Advantage, What You Thought Was a Diagnosis, Maybe Your Greatest Strength. The author says, you know, symptoms include creativity, multitasking, risk-taking, high energy. So people with ADHD are more likely to grow up to be entrepreneurs. So it seems like there's this newer positive take on this.
There is. I think you still have to be careful to look at the degree of how much it's impacting daily life. And so one of the reasons why I'm really interested in it is because it mimics what somebody looks like when they're under a lot of high stress burden. So high vigilance, kind of twitchy nervous systems, you know, inability to really focus well is also what comes with a high stress burden. Either you've been exposed to stress early as a child and you tend to be more vulnerable to stressful situations, or you're living under a pretty high stress burden. And so you have to make sure that whatever behaviors a child is emitting, that they are doing it within some ability to still be able to perform under certain environmental contexts. Across all contexts, if somebody is unable to really achieve the learning outcomes and to participate meaningfully in life, there may be some other things at issue. And so looking at how much they're sleeping, what the home life is looking like, what other kinds of things might be going on are really important. And so you really have to look at the child within the context and really and the adult within the context and really pay close attention to all the other things that might be affecting their behavior.
Interesting. So, and we'll probably get back to this, you know, the idea that don't be so quick to make a diagnosis of a brain disorder. There may be environmental factors.
Yes.
That are causing those behaviors to come out. I want to bring Dr. Davis into this, too. And Dr. Davis, you've been looking at this for a long time, too. I just wonder what you think about, you know, this sort of evolution on how we think about ADHD.
It's always been a disorder that is defined by symptoms that we all have to a certain degree. I mean, every one of us has days where we're not paying attention or a little more fidgety or maybe a little more impulsive, and so it's basically always been sort of a dimensional or quantitative disorder in terms of the degree that those symptoms are really there, and also how much they're affecting us. I think that the main thing that discriminates folks with and without ADHD, if you're looking at it more as a yes or no diagnosis, is just the degree of impairment. I mean, by definition, these are folks that have had enough number of symptoms at a significant range that's developmentally inappropriate, that's different than their peers, but they also have to be getting in the way of their ability to function in multiple areas, multiple potential locations or settings. And often the impairment of function is the more deciding factor in terms of who winds up getting diagnosed with that clinically or not.
Impairment of function. Give us more of a layperson description, Dr. Davis, of what you're talking about there.
So, I mean, if you think sort of a typical, say, 11-year-old kid, they're functioning at school. They're having to get along with peers. They're having to make new friends. They're developing new interests and in areas that they are trying to get better at and keep up with their peers with. At school, they're having to pay attention for extended periods of time, not play too rough on the playground, not do things that make their teachers or their peers turn away from them. And then at home, there's all sorts of different sort of standard tasks that we as people have to go through growing up, and then not only that, folks that attend church or going to Boy or Girl Scouts, or there are lots of different areas where we're asked to behave in a certain way and focus and do things that don't alienate or disrespectful to other people.
So impulse control sounds like what you're talking about there.
Well, that's part of it too. In adulthood, it's different. I mean, we have more and more as kids or patients that have these sort of symptoms grow up, they're having more trouble in their relationships with their significant others or with their bosses or coworkers. So the area of dysfunction changes as we get older.
Sure, and the consequences really get bigger. You know, I want to ask you this, Dr. Davis, but everybody, do we know what causes this, Dr. Davis? I mean, if you looked at an ADHD brain versus a regular brain, if I could put it that way, would you see some differences in that brain?
It's a great question, Laura. I mean, I think what's happened over the years, initially the first people that were described with this clump of symptoms were people that had the initial diagnosis was called minimal brain disease, which sounds like a pretty bad diagnosis to have. But over the years, neuroimaging and other sorts of research have looked at what separates folks that are diagnosed or not diagnosed with the disorder. And a lot of it seems to be the level of activity in the parts of our brain that control our attention span and our ability to resist impulses. People that are diagnosed with ADHD tend to be less efficient in the way their brains work. They're using circuits in their brains that take longer to get through and may not work as well or get off course more easily. So there are some actually neuroimaging findings that tend to discriminate people with and without ADHD. Those are still not how we diagnose the disorder, though, unfortunately, that's still considered experimental. It's still a clinical diagnosis.
Yeah, and we should definitely talk about that because that's controversial, the way we diagnose it. But I'd love to hear from you too, Professor White. The brains of ADHD people versus regular brains, if I could put it that way, are different. That's really interesting.
Yeah, so I don't really ever know how to understand that because good neuroscience tells you the brain constructs under both nurture capacity and nature capacity. So it's nature with nurture. It's never been separated. So from the time a brain really is in utero developing, there are interactions with the environment that are going on all the time to help construct what will eventually be the adult brain. Interactions with adults early on help you learn behavior regulation.
FaceTime, for example.
Exactly.
Seeing adult faces.
Exactly. And so when you end up with a neuroimaging of a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old brain, you can't really, I don't think, pull apart that which you were born with and that which was constructed through the interactions with the environment. And I think that this is a little controversial, I know, but I'll step into it for a bit. Adult caregivers really are the first line in learning how to self-regulate behavior. And when adults, really good sensitive, interactive adults are in synchrony with children early on. The give and take, the learning and ability to regulate one's behavior and emotions starts to really develop and unfold. In situations where those symbiotic relationships are not perhaps as synchronous, or there's disharmony, or there are partners that are not as skilled at developing that, you end up with children, I think, who end up as adults who don't really know how to regulate their emotions well and their behaviors well. And it's not that anybody stepped away necessarily purposefully to create this, but it happens. And I think we see more and more of it. I see more students in the classroom today who don't really understand the emotional and the behavioral impact of staying on their cell phones in social contexts. Nobody has imparted to them that's breaking a boundary.
Well, this is controversial, what you raise, because some parents may hear it, Professor White, as your child has ADHD because you didn't do a good job with him or her when he was a baby or a toddler.
I know. And that is not the message that I mean to impart, but I think that, part of it lies there.
Well, and we did a whole series last year on children in poverty, and we did look at the effects, for example, of kids who grow up in, very difficult environments, drugs, alcohol, yes, homelessness, and so forth. So those stressors do have an effect on the psyche or the brain. But I can see that David Parker wants to jump in, and I know do too, Dr. Davis.
Yeah. Well, I think early intervention really does make a difference. If kids understand who they are, and they understand possibly they are inattentive, and the learning environment is set up so they can be successful, I think the likelihood of them not developing other problems is better, and so I think again, trying to get kids to understand where their stressors are, how to be organized, what are their tolerances, and have them be successful so that they don't, again, acquire the underachieving syndrome, which is, I can't learn well in the classroom.
So it sounds like, and David, correct me if I'm wrong, that you're less interested in, you know, why this happens and more interested in just, all right, here you are. Let's help you manage it.
Well, I'm the practical guy because I get the kids, and we need to teach them, and they need to learn. So you can set up a learning environment that's appropriate for those kids. I mean, we talked about the strengths and weaknesses of ADHD. You know, Pulsive Kid is also really spontaneous. So if you're brainstorming as a learning activity, they can be really good. It's a sustained attention and task, so you have to break those periods up so that they can get a little break. And there's multiple applications like that. But I think the earlier you get them to understand who they are and not that they're a diagnosis, I think the healthier they'll be moving forward.
Again, that idea of a spectrum. Here's mm-hmm. where you are. Here's your strengths.
Right.
Here's your weaknesses,
definitely
but
your
here's
strengths.
Your strengths. Yeah. So, Dr. Davis, nature and nurture, we're starting to go there. What do you think? I mean, is a brain born ADHD or is it caused by something in the environment?
Well, it's really a great question, and I don't think any of us are completely smart enough to know the definitive answer. I think it's probably somewhere in between. But one way that we look at whether things are nature or nurture is by doing genetic studies where you're looking at twins that are either identical twins or fraternal twins. If it's truly a genetic disorder, something you're born with, you would expect that the identical twins have a much higher level of concordance. They both would have a disorder or both not have a disorder. The other way that those sort of questions are looked at is by looking at twins that are raised apart from each other. Sometimes twins are wind up in different homes, and then that would suggest if there was a couple of siblings that were twins that were raised apart that both had the disorder of ADHD, that would be more of a biological disorder. And out of all the different mental health problems and actually most of the medical problems, ADHD is one of those disorders that has the highest genetic concordance between twins and within families. And, you know, certainly that could be an environmental thing, but it's kind of hard to imagine how being raised in a completely different home as a twin and having the disorder would be due to the environmental factor. It's really one of the most heritable or genetic disorders that we treat in medicine, and that does suggest that I think there's an underlying biological component. I agree, though, completely with Dr. White that there's a strong environmental issue with it, and kids that have or more prone to distractibility or more prone to these other symptoms can certainly benefit tremendously from environmental adjustments. And I also worry about the excessive amount of screen time and some of the other things that we're doing more and more in our society, less exercise, less
time
ability
outdoors.
Right. I mean, all the things that our parents used to tell us we needed to do, I think kids are getting a lot less of. And I do think that's going to have a significant impact on this clump of symptoms in the long run.
You know, real quickly, Dr. Davis, returning to something that both our guests in studio raised, the idea that there's a positive side to this, that, we're only focusing on the negative in our sort of overdiagnosed culture, but that ADHD can be an entrepreneurial spur, a creativity spur, and so forth.
I mean, I certainly see it. I've worked with enough folks, and even within my extended family, there are enough folks that have a certain degree of these symptoms. I think that often they're the life of the party. So if they learn how if folks with this disorder learn how to play to their strengths and what their strengths and weaknesses are and get around the things that are more challenging for them, they can be very successful. I mean, I think that presidential candidates have sometimes been thought to have ADHD here and there, too.
All right.
I won't go on that.
For a topic for another day, perhaps. We will be back in just a moment. Let's start hearing from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, rethinking ADHD. We're taking another look at the diagnosis and treatment of this. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. If you have a child who's been diagnosed with ADD or ADHD, or if you yourself have been told you have this disorder, we'd love to hear from you, your questions, comments, thoughts about some of the issues that we're raising this morning. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. With us in studio, David Parker, founder and director of Parker Education, a private day school and tutoring center in Concord that works with kids who have a wide array of learning challenges. Also with us, Barbara White, developmental psychologist and occupational therapy professor at UNH. And joining us from Hanover, Dr. Burl Davis, pediatric psychiatrist at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine, who specializes in the pharmacological treatment of ADHD and other mood disorders. One more time, that exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And all of you, let's go right to our listeners now. And Pam is in Milford. Hi, Pam. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I would ask your guest to speak on the connection of food and ADHD. I actually have a coworker who has two children, very sensitive to food coloring and certain foods that has triggered this diagnosis in her children. She opted to not go the medication route initially to try and find maybe what the source was or what the trigger points were. And for them, it is food-related. It's not the first time I've heard that, and I wondered if there's been more study on that.
Pam, thank you. Yeah, and this is something, Professor White, I'm going to turn to you first on this. This is something that I've heard people raise before, whether it's a change in diet. I think I read recently that magnesium deficiency can play a role. What are your thoughts on food and vitamins in terms of ADHD?
You know, I think we're uncovering a whole new world, a new galaxy in terms of nutrients, food, exposure to various things in the environment. This is not my area of expertise, so I can't speak to it specifically. But I can say that nutrition and sleep are huge for anybody's ability to perform well. And the extent to which we don't give ourselves adequate nutrients and maybe expose ourselves to things that might make us more sensitive to certain things really impacts your ability to perform well. So I think maybe Dr. Davis or
yeah,
Mr. Parker might be better.
Yeah, I'll throw it to you first, Dr. Davis. Yeah, and we did a whole show, by the way, on sleep and just how kind of scary it is that as a society we're getting more and more sleep deprived. So there is definitely something there. Dr. Davis and then David Parker. Go ahead, Dr. Davis.
Well, I would say this regarding diet. I mean, I have folks, parents that tell me that there does seem to be some change or some variability in their kids with certain dietary experiences, and I absolutely don't doubt that could be true. I think the problem is that it's so nuanced, and there's so many different stories, and also that there's not a lot of research or research evidence to support one particular food tending to be more of a problem. I think every kid's situation is different. So I don't think it hurts to look into those things. But if a child or an adult is still having these sort of problems, in the long run, I certainly think there are other things that you can do that have better research support that they work.
Yeah, thank you for the call, Pam. Go ahead, David Parker.
Well, I haven't seen research that suggests that one particular toxin impacts ADHD. On the other hand, I would agree with the other people on the panel. Things like diet, exercise in particular, seems to really mitigate some of the extreme conditions that come with somebody that's highly ADHD. And a good night's sleep and managing for stress is really important.
Yeah, it's been a little tricky lately with the weather so cold to say go outside and play for 3 hours, but absolutely. Go ahead, Professor White, and then I have another question for you, Dr. Davis.
I just could jump in real quickly for a plug for exercise. Exercise really burns off stress hormones, and so if you have any hypervigilance or twitchiness at all and you tend to be a person who runs that way naturally or you're a person who's impacted behaviorally by that, exercise really should be a part of your life as sort of a self-medication to burn off those stress hormones. We do not do it enough, and we do not have our children doing it enough.
You know, Dr. Davis, I did want to jump in with you on this idea of medication and the big debate, you know, as to whether we're over-medicating our kids. I remember a book a couple years ago, it was Generation Medication and so forth, and a lot of people feeling that we do over-medicate our kids at the first sign of ADD. You have said, though, that the notion that ADHD is overdiagnosed and overtreated is just not supported by population studies. Give us a little more there. What do you think?
Well, first off, if you look just around the country at studies that look at the frequency of the disorder, and then you look simply at the number of people that are getting prescribed medications, there's a much, much lower rate of folks that are actually being treated. Now, it does vary tremendously from community to community, which suggests that, you know, there may be some issues in certain communities. It may be that folks are more vigilant and they may be over-diagnosing or over-treating. And there's no question that could be the case. I mean, working here on the Dartmouth campus, we have students that come in and swear up and down, especially after I give the lecture to the medical students on ADHD, that they have the disorder, and yet they've gotten to medical school and done pretty well up to this point. So
if you're in Dartmouth Medical School, you're not doing too poorly.
Well, apparently not, but invariably I'll have five or six people at the end of the lecture that want to know where they can get assessed for it. So you know, again, it really comes back to that idea of if you've got the symptoms and you've got the impairment that separates you from peers around you, that's really what we've got to go by. I do agree with Barbara's point about exercise, though. I think that even just getting up and taking a break every hour, to go walk around or get the wheels turning can make a huge difference in people's ability to focus. And you know, those sort of environmental or things that we can do without a medication, I think, are very important, too.
So, Dr. Davis, to the broader societal fear that we are over-medicating, ADHD, that too many kids and young adults are on Ritalin and this is causing all sorts of problems, you would say good headline, but not really true?
I would say just the numbers don't suggest that, but there are certainly cases that I see of children that have been treated for years that, I'm not sure it was looking at the teacher's reports of their symptoms and the parents' reports and the way that the kid looked in the being examined and the ratings of all the other people around them didn't really suggest that it was a legitimate diagnosis. I mean, yeah. You do see some of that. And unfortunately, it's still a clinical diagnosis. The only way we can make the diagnosis is by asking lots of different people that work with the patient and trying to make our best guess. There's not a magic test right now that tells us if someone does or doesn't have it otherwise.
Yeah, clinical diagnosis, just for the regular audience, is a clinician, a doctor, whoever, makes an assessment. There's no sort of blood test or, cheek swab test or something like that. David Parker, you're nodding. I can tell you want to jump in here.
Well, over the many years that I've treated students with ADHD, medication sometimes has been a wonderful component of their treatment, and it can make a really big difference. For other kids, it doesn't seem to. I would mention that medication alone usually isn't the answer, because they have to learn the requisite skills that come with working with this with ADHD, and a lot of those executive functioning skills, if they're not taught, and they get it to middle school or high school, it's much harder to teach them at that point.
So the pill isn't the magic bullet.
Usually it isn't, but it sometimes can really make a difference with kids' ability to function in a sustained way.
I can see you want to jump in, Professor White.
I do want to jump in because I've been fascinated with about 15, 17 years ago, students telling me how they used to take it for studying. They would, I got to know a lot of
students. The study
Correct.
Drug. Yep.
So I have done two studies for diversion at the university. And one was done in 2002. I found about 17 to 18% of the students at that time admitted to taking Ritalin, methylphenidate, Adderall off-label, meaning that they took it for studying purposes in bolus form. They would snort it. They would take a number of pills just so they could study better. And because it's a stimulant, it actually works for all of us in the same way. It focuses our attention. So it's not differentially suited to just people with a certain diagnosis or not. And so I redid that study just a couple years ago. I've got about a quarter of the students who responded, about 1,000 students responded in, saying that they also divert. Well, the interesting thing to me is that this is a Schedule II drug, so you can only get it through prescription. These students that were taking it get it from students who have the prescription. The inference here is that students who have the prescription are not taking it themselves, but they're selling it. And so that, to me, has always made me scratch my head. If you have eyeglasses and they work really, really well for you, and in some cases I think that's the case with some of these meds, but there's a group of students for whom they're just happy to sell off their eyeglass. They don't really use it. They don't need it in the same way, and they're selling it off to other students, and they themselves will also say they divert it, so that even if you hold the prescription, sometimes they'll hold back, and then they'll take it for bolus just for studying when they need it. So there's this diversion going on here. I'm sure it's not just our institution. It's a national issue where students are not fessing up to taking the medication in the way that they have been prescribed.
I'm surprised they're so honest on those surveys. Let's go back
anonymous
to our listeners. And Jimmy's calling from Tilton. Hi, Jimmy. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hello. I'm calling in appreciation for your discussing this, the whole subject. I think one of the issues that I had was that I refer to it not as a disorder, but as a condition. I was in an era before there was such a thing as ADHD, and so I learned life skills. You know, the inability to sit still can be an advantage and a disadvantage. But I was able to make it through college and go on to graduate school as well. And I think one of the things we need to do is not necessarily refer to it as a negative. Dr. Hallowell, in his book, Answers to Distraction, pointed out some very good components of qualities that we do have with ADHD or ADD, and their creativity and high energy and other facets are positives. And perhaps in life we need to look at those and look at our young person if he or she has the qualities, not to refer to them so negatively.
Yeah, and we talked about this mm-hmm. earlier, but David Parker, I love your thoughts there as well.
Well, I think positive psychology works. None of us neurotypicals, if we any of us are, like to be labeled by something we're not good at. I'm not particularly organized. I'm not, you know, I may be considered ADHD, but I want to be defined by what I do well. And I think that's a really important point that in education and in treatment that you're building on strengths and compensating for areas that need some attention.
Did you call yourself a neurotypical?
I haven't heard that before. Oh no, that's a funny term we use in our worlds.
So you don't have any sort of identifiable.
Well, I can tell you just a quick thing. When you guys got in touch with me last week, I read the email and then I forgot to get back to you.
That's okay. A lot of people do that.
So no, but I got distracted and was doing other things. So, oh yeah, I think any of us, when we get really stressed or we have a lot on our plate, we'll have some of these conditions. But the positive attention to people's behavior really helps these kids and adults.
Well, so understood. And Jimmy, thank you for the call. And we definitely talked about, you know, more and more people seeing some of the advantages of this. Still, Dr. Davis, you know, if you're a public school teacher and you have 25 kids in a class and limited resources, at some point, you know, the couple kids who may have ADHD need to be, I don't know how to say it, managed, handled better. I mean, she can't have them running around the room.
Well, I think job one is to make sure you have the right reason for those behaviors. And there are all sorts of other things that are good imitators of inattention and hyperactivity and impulsivity. And it could be, others have mentioned, environmental factors. Kids that have been traumatized at home could be distractible or impulsive or more moody. Kids that aren't sleeping well, sleep apnea is a common symptom of distractibility during the day. There are medical problems that can imitate other medical problems, such as endocrine issues. Drug and alcohol issues, and especially in our older kids or grown-ups, can look like ADHD. The other thing that complicates it is that many folks with a true diagnosis of ADHD are going to have more than just that. They may have depression. They may have anxiety. They may also have other sorts of disorders that complicate the assessment of ADHD and make it harder to treat it.
Yeah, frankly, what people call co-occurring.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think that's always an area that I've been especially interested in. Folks with ADHD are at a higher risk of developing, say, comorbid depression or having co-occurring anxiety disorders. And so really a good assessment, it takes some time, and you got to make sure you're looking for all these other potential explanations for the same symptoms. You got to get the diagnosis right or have as right as you can get it before you jump to treatment decisions, especially in college kids that are coming in saying that they did real well on their roommate's Adderall and they think they have ADHD too and they'd like to get a prescription.
Yikes. Yeah. So, but it sounds like you're saying, Dr. Davis, that, you know, for people who are worried about over-medicating their kids and absolutely understood, there may be other problems that could be helped by the ADD medication. I mean, can ADD medication also help with the anxiety and depression? And no? Yes? What do you think, Dr. Davis?
Well, it's interesting. It depends on what the kid's anxious about. If they're anxious because they're doing poorly in school, or their other kids don't want to play with them because they can't sit still, or that sort of a thing, and they really have the ADHD symptoms preceded that anxiety. That gives you a better case to say that it may be ADHD and anxiety together. And treating the ADHD symptoms may help a child like that to have less anxiety. On the other hand, kids, there may be anxious kids that are worried about all sorts of different things that are distractible and look like they could have ADHD symptoms, but really the underlying issue is anxiety. And treating the anxiety with an ADHD medicine is not going to work, and it may be harmful.
May make it worse because some of these drugs are stimulants. Go ahead, Professor White.
I was just going to mention that, you know, that's a pretty scary circular place to go, because if you have anxiety, giving you a psychostimulant isn't really going to help you with managing that anxiety. There are a whole lot of other tools that one might look to first. And I think we also have this sense then that if you feel any sort of emotional upset, any sort of angst about something, that you should pop a pill for it. And, you know, I'm seeing a lot of students who come in with self-proclaimed stress disorders. And I teach in my course on stress, human stress. Stress is a good thing for you. And in the right environment, it's going to be a capacity builder. You need to learn to tolerate good stress and begin to, you know, figure out what's chronic or bad or distress, and learn the difference between the two. Embrace the one, manage the other. But psychostimulants would not be the best way to manage that.
Let's take another call. Robin's in Wilton. Hi, Robin. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi. Yes, thank you so much for having this discussion. I have been a nanny for 30 years and in 8 families and 20 children. I've seen quite a few of this disorder, which it really is a disorder in my mind. And it's all a matter of how it's handled. I've seen educated parents who really function in a clinical way, and they follow through for their children and get them the help in their life so that they can balance life and be launched into a productive adulthood. And then I've seen parents who are reluctant to deal with it, and those children are not as successful as the ones who have parents who recognize it and seek out the help that they need to offer their children balance.
Well, Robin, thank you for calling, and good to hear from you as a longtime nanny. And we'll follow up after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Rethinking ADHD, another look at the diagnosis and treatment of attention deficit disorders. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Your questions and comments about this are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. 892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. And all of you, just before the break, Robin called in. It was great to hear from her. David Parker, a longtime nanny, had worked with, you know, many families and many kids, and talked about, you know, the role of parents in all this. Some parents kind of taking the challenge head on, and others not so much. But it's a lot for parents, and it's so sort of difficult to wade through the diagnosis and figure out what the right avenue to take is.
Well, it's I agree. I mean, kids come with parents and families, and part of my work is working with the families to understand how this diagnosis is manifesting itself with their childhood learning. And there are many environmental factors that play into that. I think Dr. Davis's point of making sure that the diagnosis is accurate, or when you're looking at a situation, to see that you're looking at it with the right lens, because typically, if you just look at behavior, you could be wrong as to what's causing it. So you really have to look at the function of that behavior. What's the environment? What happened preceding it? Did the kid get sleep? Is he tired? There's all those things that need to be considered. And parents need to understand how they can help and how they, you know, how they can be unhelpful in terms of working with their kids.
What do you mean by function of that behavior?
Well, there may be two reasons why someone is acting tired in class, okay? It could be that they're really bored and distracted. It could be that they're hungry. It could be that they didn't get sleep the night before, and it all looks the same. So we do what's called an FBA and look at the behavior and analyze it and say, why is this going on? Because there could be many variables.
Do you have parents come to you, David, and say, you know, I want your help in deciding whether I should put my kid on medication or not?
I usually refer them to their family doctor because I don't want to be the person making that decision. I think it's a parent decision and a family decision. Stan. So they try to ask me, but I won't. You know, it doesn't mean I'll give them an answer.
Yeah. Well, let's take another call, all of you. Lots of people want to jump in our conversation. Ben's in Manchester. Hi, Ben. Go ahead. You're on the air. Okay, I guess we lost Ben. Ben, you can call back, 1-800-892-6477. To New London, Mary's on the line. Hi, Mary. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi. Can you please tell me, how often is ADHD associated with autism?
And why do you ask, Mary? It's a good question.
Just because, you know, we have a family member involved, and I just was wondering.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for the call. And Dr. Davis, what do you think? There is a lot of concern about rising autism numbers these days.
It's interesting, with the last diagnostic criteria a few years back, you could not make the diagnosis of ADHD if someone had an autism disorder. And but in clinical situations, we saw so many kids that had autistic symptoms and an autistic diagnosis that had distractibility or impulsivity or hyperactivity, and the more recent diagnostic criteria have said that you can have both. And we certainly see a lot of it. I have an autism spectrum disorders clinic that I'm working with kids all over the state and young adults that come in with a primary diagnosis of autism and are having a lot of ADHD-ish looking symptoms, and many of them will respond not at a higher maybe at a lower rate, but they will respond to the same sorts of treatments for ADHD or for co-occurring anxiety disorders or depression or the other things that people without autism can get to.
It's tricky because, you know, according to manuals and so forth, people tend to get siloed. But it sounds like you're saying, Dr. Davis, people have all sorts of issues going on. You can't just say, you know, you're A and you're B and you're C.
Right. I mean, I think we tend to certainly have certain things in clumps. I mean, people have red hair and freckles together, or ADHD and disruptive behaviors, or ADHD and anxiety, so things just don't occur by themselves, and or often don't occur by themselves. So you really have to have an open mind and consider other possibilities too.
I wonder too, Dr. Davis, I asked David Parker this, and he's not going to tell parents, yes, you should or no, you shouldn't medicate. How do you help parents navigate that very difficult decision?
Well, I often, or at least fairly often, I'll get referrals from parents who've been told by the school, my kid's acting up at school and they think he's got ADHD and we don't want to be here, but here we are. And that's not an unusual referral at all in my line of work. And What I always tell folks is that they're really the boss. I mean, we'll give up our best guess, but it's up to the parents and the patient to make their decision about whether or not they want treatment if they truly have a diagnosis or not. I also think that out of all the different mental health conditions that we treat pharmacologically, the batting average is as good as any of them. I mean, there's about a 75% or 80% response rate for kids that have ADHD that are seen in clinical settings. So that's part of the reason I think people worry about it being overtreated sometimes. The medications are fairly fairly less risky as far as side effects go. I think Dr. White's correct to point out that diversion is an issue, especially on college campuses, but these are generally the first-line medications for it. It doesn't take weeks and months to figure out if you're on the right track or not. So I think that's part of the reason more and more people are getting diagnosed and treated, and maybe some are getting incorrectly diagnosed and treated.
Do you think, Dr. Davis, that schools push parents to give these drugs to their children so that they'll have an easier time controlling their classrooms?
Yes, in a nutshell. I mean, I think there are some kids that are challenging in a classroom setting, and especially in school districts where they don't have the availability of some of the things that David has in his shop, you know, with more individualized treatment approaches and more individualized attention. I think a lot of schools are overwhelmed around the country, and so there are going to be some kids that are having these sort of behaviors that may not be appropriately diagnosed with ADHD or may not really warrant treatment so much with medicines. These other things could be helpful as well.
Professor White?
Dr. Davis, thank you for that. I think that was a brave thing to say, and I think that's accurate. I think you can also find the evidence for that in the medication that's given on Monday through Friday, and the child is off for Saturday and Sunday. I've often scratched my head. If you have truly a problem, if you have a disorder, how can that be so situationally and contextually taken based on your environment? So some kids will get their medication Monday through Friday, and they don't get it on Saturday or Sunday.
And they're fine?
Well, define fine. I think what we're talking about right. is that, in fact, the environment is driving the use of the medication rather than the need of the child driving the use of the medication. And so it logically seems to me if you have a disorder, it's the need of the person that should drive the medication, not the environment that drives the medication dosing. Right?
That's right up your alley, David Barker. Right, I know you need to jump in
that,
there.
But we see that, you know, I appreciate what both my colleagues here are saying, because many times I'll hear families coming in and say, well, you know, the teacher thinks my child should be on medication. And I agree with what Dr. White said. Contextually, if you're asked to sit in a class and listen and take notes and pay attention and be quiet, if that's the classroom setting, a kid with ADHD is going to be really challenged, you know. So if that's and I think that's less and less. My colleagues in the schools, I think, have learned a lot about ADHD. They know how to give kids breaks. They do have them go out in recess, and they give them the support for the executive functioning skills. But I think you still hear it. I think maybe less, I'm not sure, that, you know, schools will ask them to get medication before they've actually been diagnosed.
Let's take some more calls. So did you want to jump in,
yeah,
Dr. Davis? Yeah.
One comment about the weekend non-treatment. The reason for that is stimulant medicines work on the days you take them. They don't work on the days you don't take them. Many parents have sort of heard the opinion from folks like Dr. White that these medicines are some skepticism about the medicines, and they try up and down. They resist having their kids be on the medicine. Eventually, they may give the medication a try and see there's a dramatic impact, but they feel guilty about giving their child the medicine 7 days a week, even if the kid's having some symptoms on the weekends that make it continue to be impairing for them. I mean, by definition, they're going to have impairment on the weekends, and many of these parents have such a kind of a mixed feeling or feelings of guilt about their child having to have treatment that they don't get the medicines on the weekends.
So yeah, we're sort of conflicted about this, aren't we, Dr. Davis? Sort of we go back and forth. We say, here's the magic pill. It's going to cure ADHD. And then we hear over-medication nation. And then we go back. And so just in that example you gave of sort of Monday through Friday, not on the weekends, parents being conflicted, that's a societal reflection, isn't it?
What is? And 20 years ago or 30 years ago, the kind of the standard treatment was not to give the child a medication on the weekend. There's still some doctors that go by that. It helps kids if they're having issues with weight loss or not eating enough to gain some weight back. But I think more and more when we've realized the degree of impairment that kids with a legitimate diagnosis experience, you know, playing Little League on Saturday or at church on Sunday or whatever their activities are, I think the more we're realizing that 7 days a week is probably the better way to do it. But, you know, ultimately the parents are the bosses on that.
Let's take another call. This is Penny in Stratham. Hi, Penny. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. My question is, I know that I was diagnosed with ADHD at 36. And I'm wondering if you can comment on the possible underdiagnosis of girls in schools because the symptoms are different, the less hyperactivity, so they kind of go under the radar.
You know, Penny, I'm so glad you called. And David Parker, I remember one of my neighbors a long time ago, her daughter, you know, when she got to college, she said, "Oh my gosh, turns out I have ADD and that's why I struggled so much in high school and now I'm on medication and I'm doing so much better." And it did turn out that there was an underdiagnosis among girls, perhaps, although some people say we overdiagnose boys. I love your thoughts, David.
Well, I mean, we have ADD and then we have ADHD with hyperactivity. I think girls, and it's more of a societal issue, but girls don't tend to act out as much. And so they may be acting in. And so I think – I'm not sure what the statistics are on this, but I would say that typically, you know, more boys are diagnosed than girls, and the behaviors just are not as extreme, I think.
Yeah. Good to hear from you, Penny. Go ahead, Professor White.
So I hear this from students a lot, and I look at them and I say, wow, you have done amazing to get where you are. Why would you ever think that you have a disorder? You may not be the most pleasant person to sit in a classroom. You may have issues. You may have challenges. We all do. But yay for you for having found your niche. And what is it that you struggle with? Maybe that's not your area of strength. Let's think about where your areas of strength do lie. And that reframing them from, "Hi, my name is Mary, and I have an attention deficit disorder," too. "Hi, my name is Mary, and I am awesome. I have so many skills and abilities, and I have variable attention. It's a gift. It drives people crazy when they're in a conversation with me. But, oh, my gosh, do you know how many things that I have developed or created or painted or sang or done?" So I think I worry about people who feel that this is a defining moment for them, and especially later in life, rather than appreciating all that they have accomplished, they discount where they are. And that's not a criticism of our caller. I don't mean this personally to this individual. I worry about what that frame does for people's self-efficacy.
Here's an email that I want to throw to you first, Professor White. This is from Abigail. She says, "Do we know the long-term effects of ADHD medication on the brain? And what can you say to the evidence of ADHD medications suppressing a child's appetite and affecting physical development?" So some concerns about these medications, about the risks, from our emailer, Abigail. Thank you, Abigail. Go ahead,
is
Professor
that
White.
One that I could,
no. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Dr. Davis, and then Professor White. Sure.
Okay, especially since it involves medications.
Absolutely.
And long-term treatment. So the caller's question or the emailer's question is you know, I think a very appropriate one. We don't know for sure the long-term effects of stimulant use or other medications over many, many, many years. The only way we could really know that is to randomize, you know, assign two different groups to non-treatment or treatment and follow them over 15 or 20 years. So there is that issue that you know, I think hangs over all of us to a certain extent. On the other hand, we do know the effect of having untreated ADHD over many years, and it's not only an effect during school, but also, you know, a higher rate of divorce, a higher difficulty with occupational attainment later, a higher level of driver's accidents, potentially fatal accidents. I mean, there are all sorts of bad things that go along with untreated ADHD.
Wow, I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Davis.
So it's a very impairing disorder, and so there's definitely effect if you've got those symptoms and you're not doing something about them, whatever that is, medications or otherwise.
So trouble holding down a job later in life, possible car accidents, other impulsive behaviors. So there are
exactly
reasons to treat this if you think you have it.
And then let me also just address the appetite issues. That's a very common side effect with stimulant treatment. And there are all sorts of different tricks of the trade that can help kids that are not eating so well but during the time that they're on the medications. Sometimes it's a matter of, you know, supplementing with calories or changing the meal times or things like that. But almost always, I would say, if a kid's doing well on a stimulant, we can figure out a way to get around that particular side effect. It's usually not a deal buster with the kids that I'm seeing or the adults that I'm seeing with that.
Abigail, thanks for the email. To you too, Professor White, concerns about the risks of long-term medication use.
So I've asked students in some research projects what they think about it. And
it's been 30 years now. So.
Right, and students generally don't like taking the medications long-term. It does take away their appetite, and they feel less than. They also feel like they have been able to achieve based on medications rather than on their own personal abilities. But I also want to say that we lose we have more car accidents in this country for sleep deprivation than we do for anything that goes untreated. So I think if we were to look at just that one variable alone, we should be sleeping more adequately and longer and paying attention to that, and we would cut down on some of our car accidents. I think we also are giving these medications during critical periods of neural pruning. Neuroscience tells us there are critical periods in childhood where the brain is going through some major reshifting. We know that these stimulants play around with the dopamine regulation and upregulation system, and dopamine drives a lot of our cravings for things that make us feel good. So I think it's risky. I really do. I don't think we know enough about the long-term effects of this, and I just think it's a scary path.
Well, we will close it out there, but it sounds like more than enough to pick up on for another day. Dr. Davis, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. Appreciate you having us.
That's Dr. Burl Davis, pediatric psychiatrist at Dartmouth Geisel School of Medicine. Professor White, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Barbara White, developmental psychologist and occupational therapy professor at UNH. And David Parker, good to have you too. Thank you for your time.
This was fun.
David Parker, founder and director of Parker Education, a private day school and tutoring center in Concord. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Andrew Perella this week. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski-Larson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.